Someone's doing it. I think we're on, are we?
Yep.
Right, okay. Well, welcome to everyone, particularly those of you that are here for the first time. And so you'll soon pick up what happens, as you've just explained. We like you to contribute from time to time, but we don't go into groups and we don't do it formally like that. So just try and join in as and when you can. If you've not been before, let me just give a brief recap of what we looked at in our first 2 weeks. We're doing a series what I'm calling Listening to the Jewish Jesus, which means looking through the gospel at many of the things that Jesus said or situations where there's a great background, stuff that needs explaining from that point of view, so that we get a better understanding of the things that he said and what it meant. So we looked, first of all, at what it meant for someone to be called a rabbi. I looked at that, and also what it meant to be a disciple, and then what the relationship was like between them, because it was very much a matter of commitment. It wasn't just a casual thing. And we looked at the sort of excuses people made and how Jesus dealt with that, and the cost of discipleship in terms of family, commitment, and so on. So we've got two more topics which will fit in nicely, I think, into this session, and you'll see how they sort of relate together later. But anyway, off we go with the first one. Now, I don't know if you're like me, if you ever watch quiz programs, and when the question on the Bible comes up, you sort of cringe because you know that they're going to really struggle with even the simplest ones. But I think if there's one question that just about everybody could possibly get right, it would be, who betrayed Jesus? I think we're on fairly safe grounds with that, even with those who are not familiar with Christian things at all. Everybody knows it was Judas. How do you know? Well, that's a question you might think of. I won't spend time sort of quizzing you on this. Most of you will come up with, oh, well, didn't Jesus make it really obvious, particularly at the Last Supper? He announced it and he handed Judas something. It was all very clear and obvious. But in fact, there's a bit more to sort of dig around on that. So if you've got your Bibles ready, I think the first place to talk to take you to is in Luke 6:16. Luke 6:16. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you something. But if you found Luke 16, you might want to just double check Matthew 10:4. Matthew 10:4 and Mark 3:9. So we've got Luke 6:16, Matthew 10:4, and Mark 3:19. So they're similar passages. And the point I'm wanting to make, well, let's see if you can understand what I'm saying here. What do you notice when you look at those three verses in each case? Bearing in mind that I've already said we're looking at Judas. Any ideas? Anyone got anything to contribute here? We've got a couple of hands. Christine, you're muted, by the way. Christine, you're muted.
Okay. Ellen, would you like to unmute yourself?
Yeah, they all say who betrayed him.
They do. And I don't know if you noticed that before, but this is the very first mention of Judas in the list of disciples. And right at the beginning, we are told very clearly he betrayed him or he became a traitor and something like that. Now, the point I'm getting at here is that right from the very first moment his name is mentioned, he's labelled in that particular way. Now, in most sort of stories or dramas of some kind, you wouldn't give that away right at the beginning. This is what's now called a spoiler, you know, big spoiler alert. You're going to be told right at the beginning who did it. You wouldn't find any, crime writer giving you that away at the beginning. And it's not just there in the very first announcement of his name, but it's in several other interesting places as well. So follow these through in John 6:71, John 6:71. And again, there, it's spelt out for you. This is the point. There's a common point in all this. So, the mention of Judas, and pretty well straight afterwards, you're told, was later to betray him. So he gets labelled like that there. Turn over a couple of pages to John 12 and verse 4. John 12 and verse 4. It doesn't just say one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, objected. Oh, no, we have to be told who was later to betray him. You know, we're meant to get the message here. Something's coming up. We're not going to miss this. And all the way through, not perhaps every single time his name is mentioned, but pretty well all the way through, we get this extra little phrase of one kind or another. And when you get to, let's stick in John, to follow this through, in John 18, for instance, and in verse 2, now Judas, who betrayed him, it says, John 18, verse 2, and actually, this is the very moment in which it's going to happen. So, you know, we've been told just before it happens, and there again in verse 5, and it says, and Judas, the traitor, was standing there with him. And if you follow this through in other Gospels, for instance, in Mark 14:10, even at the very moment when all this is happening, well, it talks about there that he went to the chief priest to betray Jesus. Okay, so it's labelled there in one or two other places. So all the way through, we keep getting this big mention. So, as I said, it's not much a matter of, ooh, who done it? That's given away right at the beginning. But I suppose the question would be, how can a disciple, given what we've learned about discipleship and the closeness between a rabbi and a disciple, how can any disciple have acted against his rabbi in this way? And if you turn now to the Last Supper itself, where this is sort of mentioned again. So I'm looking now in Matthew 26. It's in the other Gospels as well, but obviously in Matthew 26, the Last Supper, verse 25. So Jesus just announced, someone here is going to betray me. And then he says, the one who has dipped his hand into the bowl, and so on. And in verse 25, Judas, oh, we're still being told, the one who would betray him, okay? But he says, surely not I, Rabbi. He seems to be surprised. He seems to be startled by all this. And yet he's already gone and collected his 30 pieces of silver. And it's as though he hasn't really been reading the Gospels up to this point. Otherwise, he would surely have spotted that every time his name is mentioned, he's going to betray Jesus. And yet there's still an element of sort of surprise here. Surely not I? Yes, it is you. So I wonder what's going on in all of this. I mean, firstly, why the gospel writers seem to keep wanting to underline all that. But could it be that he was surprised at this point because he didn't actually think what he was going to do was actually a betrayal? Now, why might that be, do you think? I'll pause for the moment to see if you want to come up with any thoughts here. After all this, could it be that Judas really didn't regard what he had already done and what he was going to do as actually an act of betrayal? Anyone, any thoughts on that? We've got one hand, I can see.
Rose. I think if greed was his modus operandi, he wouldn't have been thinking about the consequences. He did it for the money without thinking, so what's next?
Okay. And all right, that's interesting. Yeah, fair enough. Someone else got other ideas? Thank you.
And Michael, sorry.
Yeah, we think that he didn't think he was betraying Jesus. He thought that by doing it, he would provoke Jesus into action. Yeah. To rise up against the Romans, because he thought that's what he'd come for, maybe.
Yes, thank you. And others might well have heard of that particular idea. He was actually almost, might say, doing his rabbi a favour he was giving him a helping hand. He was pushing him to the point where, oh, he's bound now to do what surely he's here to do, which is to be that kind of Messiah. So basically, he's got his understanding a bit sort of muddled up, as indeed many of the disciples did. But of course, his actions led to greater consequences. So perhaps he thought that it was simply doing something that that Jesus might even approve of almost. And at the end, oh, that's in now Matthew 27, and in verse 3, in Matthew 27, verse 3, here we go again. When Judas, who had betrayed him, and so haven't we got the message by now? We've actually gone through all this. Didn't we know this? But what did Judas do when he saw that Jesus was condemned? What was his response to that?
Suicide.
Yeah, but before that?
Try to give the money back. To give the money back to the...
And it says in particular about what sort of emotions did he go through?
He was remorseful.
Yeah, and then what did he say?
Oh, I have betrayed innocent blood.
Right, now he's understood that he's actually betrayed him. Now he's saying it, and he realises that something has gone wrong at this point. It hasn't worked out as he had planned. It does seem as though all along he had not actually intended this to be the outcome. And that's why he hands the money back. And that's why, as you rightly say, as we'll look at again later, he goes out and hangs himself. Okay. Now, sorry, we're going to have to silence someone if this background noise. Okay, thank you. Anyone else want to comment at this point before I move this a little bit further on? Val?
He was a bit of a dodgy character anyway, wasn't he? Because he'd been stealing out of the common purse.
Yeah.
So that shows what his general character was like anyway. So I'd go with the greed part of it.
That's an interesting one. It certainly fits into it. But of course, Jesus still chose him anyway. He was, as it said in one of the other verses we looked at, Judas, who was one of the 12, was later to betray him. So that's why the question that I asked earlier is really important, is how could any disciple, actually act like this against his rabbi, given everything that we've looked at about the rabbi-disciple relationship? So, Helen?
I think that for me, what's significant when it says that Satan entered him at the Last Supper, you know, if we think of the Satan as the big liar, basically, so it seems like he was really, you know, whatever was going on in his mind, it was lies, really. So it seems as if kind of he was operating under, I mean, obviously, he was still responsible for. Yeah. You know, complying with Satan, if you want, but at the same time, I think this is a moment of sort of a revelation for him.
You're quite right, because that's the next point to make, really, that we can't get round that fact that in the end he was under the devil's influence. And of course, the whole Judas thing raises lots of issues about predestination and, you know, was he really always going to do this and so on.
Lynn Brindley was trying to come in.
Go on.
Fulfillment of prophecy as well.
Go on. In what way?
Well, he didn't understand, obviously, that the prophecy was there, that Jesus would die and be betrayed.
Oh, okay. But then, of course, none of the disciples understood that.
Well, fair enough.
As you may remember, every time Jesus mentioned it, they either sort of refuted it and so on. It was not part of the expectation that Messiah would die. In fact, if the person that claimed to be Messiah did die, then that proved he wasn't. That was in their thinking at this time, because they hadn't, you know, got hold of that fact till afterwards. But the other thing about him is, do you know where he actually came from, where he was born?
Yeah.
He was the only non-Galilean, wasn't he?
Where exactly did he come from then?
Iscariot.
Okay. Which means?
Iscariot.
From the place called?
Iscariot.
Iscariot, yes. Okay, Ish is man. So
he did that this morning, Val.
And this place was regarded as a place where some of the more sort of revolutionary people like the Zealots tended to be. So that might have been in his background as well in terms of this thinking that he wanted to push Jesus towards that. Okay, we're going to leave Judas at this point and come back to him a little later, because if you removed all of those little spoilers, as I've called them, all those little extra things that tell you right up to the moment and beyond what Judas was doing, and if you gave this whole gospel story to a Jew and who hadn't read it before and just asked them, you know, sort of to read it and think about it, and then at the end you said, who betrayed Jesus, they may come up with a different answer from Judas, or they may come up with two answers. One would be Judas, but who would be the other person that they would regard as having betrayed Jesus, do you think?
Peter.
Okay. Now let's look at that, because what we know is that Peter, we could say, denied Jesus, which doesn't sound too bad, really. I mean, it's not good, but it doesn't sound a major crime from that point of view. If you're still in Matthew and have a look at what it says in Matthew 26 and verse 34, Matthew 26 and verse 34, Jesus uses a slightly different word from deny. What word does he use in Matthew 26, 34?
Disown.
Now that starts to get at the heart of this. It's certainly stronger than just deny, to disown. But let's dig into this a little bit more with the account in John. So there's a lot of dashing around between different gospels. hope you can sort of keep up on this. But in John 18, we find a bit more about what actually happened. And when it came to it, the actual moment at which it all happened, although in other Gospels it might just say things like, oh, you're with him, aren't you? Or aren't you one of them? And so on. In John 18, verse 17, there's a very specific question asked by this servant girl who is about to sort of really shake Peter. What is he actually asked?
If he's one of the disciples.
Exactly. You are not one of this man's disciples, are you? And what's his reply?
I am not.
Very emphatically, I am not. What happens in verse 25?
Same again.
Absolutely the same thing again. Now, what we usually miss in all this, but this is where it's brought out with this, is at this point, Peter is not just denying a friendship or the fact that he knew Jesus or that he was, you know, around him and all the rest of it. He is publicly disassociating himself from his rabbi. After 3 years of being a devoted disciple, with all the commitment that he's had to make and with all the commitment that the rabbi will have made to him, Peter's whole life and identity for the past 3 years have been bound up in a relationship which, as we've seen, had to mean everything, including loving Jesus more than his family and all the rest of it, giving everything else up. This was the closest of all family ties and more. This was the father-son relationship that we talked about. And when you come out publicly like this, are you one of his disciples? I am not. At that point, you have betrayed your rabbi. And a Jew would look at that and say that was a worse betrayal than anything Judas did, particularly thinking further about the circumstances of it. Now, I'm not trying to sort of say that what Judas did wasn't bad, but we've already looked at the fact that to some extent he was always going to do this, and perhaps he didn't really know what he was doing. But at this moment, Peter has absolutely thrown everything away. And from this point onwards, he would no longer think of himself as a disciple. He has broken that bond and it's all over. Now, what was Peter's reaction? I asked you what Judas did at one point, but what did Peter do at that moment, on the third time when he realised and the cock crew and so on? What was Peter's reaction? If you want to text, it's in Matthew 26, 75, but you think you might know. What did he do?
He wept.
Yeah, a bit more than that, I think. He says he went out and wept.
Bitterly.
Bitterly. He wept bitterly. Why so upset? I mean, not just a little bit. Oh, blow, I've made a mess here. Oh, dear, what have I just done sort of thing. He goes out and he weeps absolutely bitterly because he realised what he had done. This was the worst thing you could do to your rabbi, was to publicly disown him and say, I am not his disciple. And Peter at this point would be in deep, deep despair about it all. And of course, anybody else that heard about it, all the other disciples and all the other followers, like the women that were following, once they knew what Peter had done, they knew that he was no longer a disciple of Jesus. Do you want to comment on that before we follow that through?
John and Lynn Brindley have had the hand up for a while.
Yeah.
No, we haven't. It's just I don't know how to put it down.
Oh, okay. Betty, then, perhaps?
It would be when you were describing before that the rabbi had virtually taken the place of the father, and he'd really orphaned himself.
Well, okay. That's a good point. I'll follow that up in a minute. Yeah, good point, as we look at something else. But it was like that, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, John?
Yeah, was this why Peter then went back to fishing?
Yes, that was the point I was going to follow up from that. And if you remember what I said before, if a rabbi decided that a disciple wasn't up to it, wasn't following him properly, he would dismiss him and send him back to his father's trade. And yes, we are going to end up in John 21, which if you were here last week, I said we would be coming back to this because we looked at one aspect of it. But I think that does explain why, from Peter's point of view, well, let's get fishing again because, you know, that's where my future now lies and so on.
Helen?
I was going to say something that probably comes into what Paul's going to say next, so I won't say it.
Well, I'm going to say Mark 16:7.
Probably is.
Mark 16:7.
I'm not sure the reference.
Well, it's outside the empty tomb on resurrection morning. Is it? Well done. I love when people are ahead of the game. What did the angel actually say then to the women in Mark 16:7? Someone else who's got it?
Go and tell the disciples and Peter.
Yes. Go tell his disciples and Peter. Now, I've sort of known that's been there for, you know, all the time I've been reading it. And somehow that makes Peter special or different. What I didn't realise was what that special or different was really about. And never mind whether the angel believed it or not, he had to say it like that because the women that were there at this point would not have counted as Peter as among the disciples. So obviously the angel wants, and therefore God wanted, Peter to know about this, but his name had to be added on. Otherwise the women at least might have thought, oh, we'll tell the other disciples, but not Peter. I think we can assume that Peter would eventually have found out and so on. And let's understand one thing. Peter hadn't been sort of sent away by the other disciples. He still hung around. They still accepted him. And I dare say the other disciples also felt a bit guilty because they'd at least all run away. And at least Peter, with John, had actually gone as far as they did in that courtyard. And the other disciples would quite possibly have said the same thing if they had been in that position. We don't know. And they might almost with pity say, oh, that could have been me. But it's in Peter's mind, really, that out of the whole sort of Jewish rabbi-disciple thing of the time, that was so bad. It was a deep betrayal. And Peter, at this point, is feeling, well, I quite understand they don't see me as a disciple anymore. Now, that would leave the book of Acts in a very strange position if we were to start reading that and suddenly find that Peter was there leading again and preaching and doing all the wonderful things. How come if he has sort of disbarred himself from being a disciple at all? And of course, the answer to that is in John 21, which we looked at last time, because we wanted at that time to look at what Jesus said to Peter three times, do you love me more than these? Because we looked at the phrase about loving Jesus more than anybody else or anything else. So we picked that bit up of it before. But as has just been said, Peter is still there with all the other disciples, or at least I think seven of them all together, in Galilee. So at least he has gone there, and the other disciples are happy to have him there, and he decides, let's go fishing. And we know what happens about the story with the fish and so on. And then, don't forget, all the time, Peter is still thinking, I don't really belong now. I've betrayed my rabbi. Something wonderful has happened. Jesus is back from the dead, but, you know, I'm still not a disciple, and so on. My betrayal has ruled that out forever. But then Jesus appears on the shore, and you know this wonderful scene that they eat the fish. There's the fire of burning coals, which was very similar to the charcoal fire that Peter had been warming himself when he denied him, or betrayed him, as we're now saying. But all the time, Peter is aware of this fractured relationship. And then I'd like to picture them going on this little walk, Jesus and Peter, perhaps just away from the other disciples, and this questioning, and Peter very humbly saying, he doesn't, as we said last week, he doesn't use the same word agape, he can only say filio. Yeah, I'm fond of you, I like you, but he's not going to boast anymore about, you know, all the others will fall away, but not me, all the others will do this, I won't, and so on. And Jesus is slowly restoring the situation. And in fact, the passage in my Bible says Jesus reinstates Peter, which is an interesting thing. You know, the headings are not inspired, but maybe they've got something here. But you don't know what Jesus is reinstating Peter into or restoring Peter unless you've understood what has been broken, what has actually been lost, what has happened here. Now, this is more than just restoring the relationship, restoring the friendship, restoring, you know, the hurt and all the rest of it, dealing with all that. There's something much bigger going on. And the two crucial words are there in verse 19. Again, you read this all the time and you just sometimes don't quite pick up exactly what's going on. What do you think those two important words are in verse 19 of John 21?
Follow me.
Follow me. Why are those significant then? Why are those the key words?
It means do as I do.
Well, yeah, but think that through a bit more. Why those two particular words?
I wanted him to be a disciple.
Sorry.
A lot of people with their hands up.
Oh, sorry.
Helen? I think you're first.
Yeah, because that's obviously what a disciple does to a rabbi, isn't it?
Yes.
So he's saying, now I'm giving you another chance to be my
right
disciple.
I just want to push that a bit more to turn it around the other way. Why did that mean so much to Peter?
Because he's saying, I'm your rabbi. He's
yeah, okay.
I don't.
I'm only pushing it a little bit more because I want you to.
That was the first thing you said.
Why did those words mean so much to Peter?
Because that's the first thing that Jesus said to him.
Right.
Come follow me, leave
exactly.
Here, come to me.
This was how Jesus called all his disciples, pretty well anyway, and certainly Peter, if you go back to the beginning of the gospel, okay, follow me, follow me. And that is the way that a rabbi selected someone to be a disciple, okay? So we might just think, oh, it's just another sort of two words, another little phrase. At this point, I can imagine Peter's heart sort of bursts everything suddenly goes, oh, wow, I'm a disciple again. Okay, yes, as you said, he's accepted me. He's called me again. And I can follow again. All the rest of it wouldn't have meant that to him. It would just have meant, oh, well, at least Jesus still, you know, he's not too mad at me. he still loves me and he wants me to love him and so on. But this is the moment when, because it says, then he said to him, follow me. And that is the reinstatement of his discipleship. And it's there again, actually, in verse 22, just to sort of reinforce it, because they then have this little chat about, well, what are you going to do about John sort of thing. It's just as though Peter can never sort of stop talking back at Jesus when really he shouldn't. He should just shut up and get on with things. But anyway, Lord, what about him? Forget all that. You must follow me. You must follow me. And I think, say, at that point, he could hardly believe his ears. But this was the moment that meant he was back, fully back. I've got one more thing to say on this, but I've got some hands up, so we'll go to them next.
Yeah, it was Jan first, I think.
From Jesus and Peter's in discourse. So that's why Peter just said, you know, I like you, because he wasn't sure what Jesus' reaction was going to be.
Yeah, okay.
He'd been completely rude and dishonourable and horrible to Jesus.
I think you're right. It Peter's lack of confidence, if you like. And it was as though Jesus might have been testing him out, that he was, you know, giving him the chance to sort of say once again, oh, yes, I really love you. I'm your best man here and all the rest of it. And Peter was much more humbled by all this. And if we're looking for a reason why this happened, Peter probably had to be broken in order to be then reinstated properly. Always look at that sort of thing. But yeah, thanks for that point. Anybody else?
Lynn was next, then Elaine, and then Jackie.
Verse 19, I've heard it explained that by telling Peter that he was going to be crucified himself, that Jesus was reassuring Peter that he wouldn't deny him again.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. In other words, this time he's going all the way to martyrdom. Yeah. Okay. And I like that, because it's then he said to him, follow me. So he's giving him the bad news first, if you like, and then saying, right, you ready for this? Follow me. Yeah, fine. I'd love to. I'm back. But it wasn't up to Peter, you see, to reinstate himself or to go to Jesus and say, oh, I'm sorry, I'll be your disciple again. Please take me back or whatever. It needed the rabbi to repeat those very words to say, you know, I accept you. You're now a disciple again. Three others we got. Let's take them.
Jackie, then Elaine.
I think when you asked about the word Paul, what I picked up during Jesus's return, Jesus' reply to Peter is, you must continually feed my lambs. You must continually tend my sheep. Yeah. You must continually feed my sheep. And then he got, you must continually follow me. So in my version, the word continually, I think, is quite important as well.
Okay, it's bringing out the tense of the verbs, you mean, or the mood of it, whatever it is, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Elaine?
Also, this is the first opportunity, the resurrected now Jesus, he's just been to the cross. He's just been on the cross, and one of the points of the cross is forgiveness for sin. Yeah. And it would be a bit strange also at this point if the resurrected Jesus wasn't exercising forgiveness for sin.
Yeah. Thank you. That set me up nicely for what I'm going to say in a minute. Do we have another hand up though?
Yes, just Jan, what's next?
Peter didn't actually say, yes, Lord.
To the follow me?
Yeah.
No, he didn't. As I say, he was then so busy wondering about John and all the rest of it. But I think in the original situation where it says follow me, they just left their nets and did it. I don't recall from the first time that you had to then sort of formally say yes or something. I think there's so much about these things, because we're not there, we don't see the body language. I can just imagine Peter's head coming up again and his eyes lighting up anyway. I think he was saying yes in all sorts of ways to that, but it was almost like a yes, yes, because it meant so much.
Yeah.
As we've got another hand up, we'll take that, and then I want to finish this section.
Anita first, and then Jackie, and then that's it.
Thank you. Paul, you asked the question earlier, why did Jesus go fishing? And when I was actually looking it up, I thought, apart from him thinking that he betrayed Jesus, I thought it was also a practical thing, because Jesus said, go to Galilee, and we don't know how long they had to wait. So he had to feed his family and his disciples. So it was a practical thing. While waiting for Jesus, he went fishing.
Well,
he needed to his livelihood.
Yeah, the probably is that again. And of course, as we know, they went out all night, which was one of the fishing practices they did, and they caught nothing. I won't go into all that side of it, but remember that had happened before on one occasion. And whenever I talk about that, I say, don't forget there's two miracles happening here. The first miracle is they fished all night and caught nothing, because that just doesn't happen. There's so many fish there, that doesn't happen, unless, of course, it's arranged by God, so that then the second miracle can happen as well. But yes, maybe they just wanted some fish. But as you say, it's almost a natural thing to do once you're thinking, well, what do I actually spend my time doing at this point? Yeah. Okay, one more then, and then...
Jackie?
I was just going to say that we get so used to, in the Gospels, reading about Peter, who speaks so often before he engages his brain. Mm. And he's been so thoroughly broken by what he's done and what's happened, that once he's reinstated by Jesus, I love that bit at the end when he turns around and says, well, what about John? What about him? Mm. Because I just feel he, you know, we've got the real proper Peter back again, Jesus, you know, not just restored him to discipleship, but just his whole personality. I just love that.
Yeah, I think there's something in that. And so if only we were there, we'd pick up so much else. I mean, I just think about Jesus' answer then. He's almost rolling his eyes or going, oh, okay, just forget about him. I'm talking to you about you. I want him, you know, so there's so much more going on there. Let me round this up by coming back to Judas. I want to finish the second. Coming back to Judas. Judas was no longer there. And we know why, because I asked you earlier what he did. And you said that he went away and hanged himself. Peter went out and wept bitterly. Judas went away and hanged himself. And that is a crucial difference there, because Judas did not believe in the forgiveness of his rabbi. Judas saw no hope, no tomorrow. And in the end, whatever else he had done, whatever you think about the coins and the kiss, as we might call it, whatever else he had done to help the process of Jesus being arrested and actually going to the cross, his main betrayal was at the end, he did not give Jesus a chance to restore him. Now, that opens up an interesting question for us. Do you think if Judas had been there, Jesus would also have taken him to one side and reinstated him? Would Jesus have forgiven Judas? As you just said, Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, has got to put into practice what he's preached. He's preached forgiveness and so on. But one thing I'm sure about, Judas didn't believe it. But do we actually think that Jesus would have restored Judas as well? And I think in that sense, what Judas did was he betrayed his rabbi's teaching in a way that at least Peter didn't. Somehow Peter hung on in all his despair about what he'd done and how it was all over and so on. He did not give up to that extent and think, well, my rabbi would not have me back again. But Judas didn't have that. And therefore, in that sense, I think Judas's betrayal was as bad as Peter's, because he didn't give Jesus a chance to forgive him and restore him. But it's fascinating to compare these two. Jesus predicted them both. He knew they're both going to happen. They were quite different in the way they played out and the way they ended up and so on. But they both fit within the context of the rabbi-disciple thing, which sometimes, as I say, we miss out on when we're reading through some of these stories. So let's have any final comments before we move on to another part of the scripture. We've got Lynn, four people.
Lynn, then Helen, then Jackie, and then Val.
You asked the question, would Jesus restore Judas? We're told that Judas showed remorse. We're not told whether he showed repentance. So, just a thought.
We don't know, I mean, what that remorse was. It might, as I say, if he was hoping that Jesus would fight back and that didn't work, then yes, he might show that kind of remorse. But you're absolutely right. It wasn't to the right kind. Yeah.
Hey, Helen?
There is that bit in John where Jesus says, except for the son of perdition, that the scriptures might be fulfilled.
Yeah. So we come back to the big mystery and debate about Judas and how much he was always going to do this and it was all planned and so on. So, yeah, fair enough.
Jackie?
I was wondering, was Peter holding on to the words that Jesus said when he said, you're Peter and on this rock I will build my church? So he kind of knew he had, God had a plan for him.
Yes. And shall we turn to that now, as that's the second thing I'm going to talk about today? Thank you, everybody, for keep setting me up like this. We'll take Val's comment, but you know now we're going to move to Matthew 16.
I understand that there are only two people in the Bible who are taken over by Satan or possessed by Satan. One is Judas and one is Antichrist. So Judas it's sort of unfair to compare Judas with Peter because he's in a different category.
Yeah, well, it's, if you like, he is by the end, certainly, yes. And you might therefore say that it was the devil that drove him to suicide, if you want, yes. I'm very, you know, happy with all that. But I'm just trying to make the contrast between the two. And maybe therefore you say at that point, Judas was so far gone that he couldn't possibly have even thought about being restored and so on. Anyway, we've seen Peter's low point. So now let's look at Peter's high point, which is in Matthew 16. This is very familiar, and you may have heard me talk on this before and so on, but it's part of the complete sort of scheme of things that I'm doing. So we're looking at Matthew 16. We'll pick it up from verse 13 to the end, where this is one of the most Hebraic passages in the whole of the New Testament. We get so many biblical references, rabbinic references, all sorts of allusions and so on, and all centered upon verse 16, really. But let me just first of all mention verse 13, because the setting is important, and it's Caesarea Philippi. Now, who wants to tell me about Caesarea Philippi? Come on, say it instead of me. Tell me everything we know about the place and why they were there and so on. Where is it? What did it mean? What was happening there? So I'm assuming people know. Yeah.
Where all the idols are.
Yeah. Okay.
Roman city.
Mount Hermon. There's a great big cave there, which was known locally by the people. It was considered to be the gate to hell.
Yeah. I'm sure many of you are wanting to tell me everything that Chris Hill has told you in the past on this, which is great. And you may even have been there, which is fine. So it's way up in the north. As you say, it's near Mount Hermon. It's in the old territory of tribal territory of Dan, which became very pagan. There was shrines and temples. It was to the god Pan that was worshipped there. And there was a particular place, really sort of cave that was turned into a shrine as well, where it was believed it was the gateway to the underworld and all the spirits came out of there and so on. So a nice place to go to. And again, let's fit it into the whole rabbi discipleship thing, because rabbis took their disciples to particular places for particular reasons. This wasn't just a day trip. Come on, let's go and have a few days up north and see how cold it really is or something. this, it's always with teaching in mind. We'll pick that up again a little bit later, but that's, the scene was significant, the place was significant, where Jesus wanted to ask this question and see what the response was. So we'll pick it up again in a minute. Now, who do you say that I am? Peter's reply in verse 16, and for comparison, I'd like you to also to look in Luke 9, verse 20, where it's both slightly different, but at the same time, it says the key point I want to make. So it's in Luke 9, 20, as well as in verse 16 here. Peter didn't just say, "You are the Christ." That's it. What else was he really saying at this point?
He's saying he's God.
Yes. By saying he's the Son of the living God, at least he's pushing in that direction, and he probably therefore is saying that. And what does it say in the Luke version?
Christ of God.
Yeah. In other words, other people might already be thinking, is he the Messiah? Yes, he probably is. Maybe some of the other disciples have begun to think along those lines. But to say you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, is far more than just your Messiah. And I believe it's at this moment that Jesus realizes he's got a revelation from the Father. This was the extra perception that showed there was a supernatural origin to Peter's disclosure. And everything is going to change from this point onwards. It's almost like this is a revelation to Jesus from the Father as well. Now, thinking again, you know, why did Jesus take them there? I think what Jesus simply did every morning was he asked the Father, what do we do today? Where do we go? And the Father will have told him that this was the next thing to do. But it's not that Jesus knows then everything that's going to happen. So he just goes and he's waiting to see what the Father's going to do. And they get into this conversation and he asks quite naturally, what are people saying about me? And then when Peter comes out with this statement with the extra bit about the Son of the living God, it's as though this time, I think it's Jesus's eyes that light up. And Jesus that goes, oh, wow, yes. Now, thank you, Father, because now something has really clicked and broken at this point. And everything that follows from here, I think, comes from the fact of that particular revelation. And now Jesus is going to have another conversation with Peter. This time definitely in the earshot of the other disciples. I don't think they go for a little walk together okay, Peter, thanks for that. Now let's have a little chat. Come over here. I think they're all meant to hear this. And at this point, he's going to say certain things to Peter. And of course, the first thing is this name change. And we'll have to think about the whole rock aspect of it. But let me just emphasize something here. I didn't mention it when we looked in John 21. You flick back to it if you need to. But when Jesus is talking to Peter in John chapter 21, how does he address him? Did you notice that? In verse 15, when they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, but what did he say to Simon Peter? Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Okay, what's he doing there? He's addressing him by his old name, which of course we've got here, Simon bar Jonas, son of Jonah, son of John, whatever. And that would be something that would resonate with Peter, because at that point, Jesus isn't calling him Peter anymore. He's calling him his old name. Okay. Now, it's interesting, we've got so used to Peter being Peter, we know he's Simon Peter, but we forget that for most of his discipleship, he was not Peter, he was Simon. The Gospels might still call him Simon Peter because he's going to be renamed, so they're using the name he's going to get. But it's not until this point that he actually gets it and everybody will start to use it. In fact, nobody now would ever think of Peter as Simon, son of John. It's just gone. It's finished from that point of view. He's always Peter, even when he wasn't yet Peter in our minds. Okay, so as I'm sure many of you know, he's going to do this little word play on you are Petros and on this Petra, I will build my church. And you're probably aware that for some traditions, mainly Catholic and Orthodox, they equate the two. And so Jesus here is effectively making Peter, the Pope, the first Bishop of Rome, whatever, the main guy, because Peter and rock, well, it's the same, and that's what it means. And other traditions, sort of Catholic, the Protestant traditions, and maybe more modern evangelical movements, say, oh, no, we don't want all that. The rock must be something else, and they point to what Peter has just said. What is the rock on which Jesus is going to build his church? It's the confession of faith that he's just made. It's the revelation that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And everybody who also makes that revelation is also, therefore, you know, hearing from the Father, is born of God. And that's how Jesus is building his church, on Peter's confession. Well, go on, let's be really Hebraic and say it's both. The point is, just because one tradition has elevated Peter to something probably way beyond he should be, it doesn't mean that Peter isn't a key figure here and that Jesus, you know, isn't wanting that to be known and seen. There is still something here specifically about Peter, that he is going to be the main man, if you like. But there is this difference between Petros and Petra. You are Petros and on this Petra. Does anyone want to explain that to us and why we need that distinction? I can see one hand's gone up straight away.
Hey, Jan?
Big rock and little rock, according to this.
Okay, thank you. Well, that'll do. anyone want to expand on that a little bit or say what they like, kind of thing? We've got someone else, I think.
Yes, Miriam?
I think I heard it referred to once as like a pebble and a giant rock.
Yeah, okay. Well, the Petra is a massive amount of solid rock. It's bedrock or it's a huge cliff. Ooh, where did we say they were? Up north in Caesarea Philippi. What would you find up there in Caesarea Philippi? You'd find a huge, huge cliff. A cliff that was over 30 meters high. And I always have to think what that means. I turn that into sort of 15 men, 2 meters for a man. So it's about 15 men tall and 150 meters wide. It was huge. And it's into this that you get the caves and the little niches for the shrines and so on. There was a huge amount of rock there, right where they were. And as I say, a rabbi always uses the natural environment. At this point, I imagine he's either pointing or looking at this rock. Caesarea Philippi was built on the top of it when he uses the word Petra. And Petros, yes, by contrast, pebble if you like, but a boulder might also work, but something unattached, a stone or separate piece of rock. I mean, we sort of use the word rock in two ways, that there's a bit of rock, it's a rock. There's rock, you know, all of it and so on. So what we get out of that really is that Peter was going to be a little bit of something much bigger. So they're not equal in that sense, but what is happening there is that Jesus is making Peter understand what he's going to be like, but also at the same time saying, it's not just you, I need lots more, it's a bigger rock, and so on. And of course, Jesus isn't saying, let's go and storm that cliff and take over this place, and I'm going to start to put a building up on top of that rock. I can imagine some Christian movements might want to take that.
There's been a note in the One New Man Bible that explains a bit more here.
Yeah, go on.
This rock is the feminine meaning rock. Peter's name is masculine, meaning a piece of a rock. The masculine form is used only for Peter's name in the New Testament. Peter's actual name was the Aramaic word kepher, which means a rock about the size of a man's hand.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it'll tell you that it was Cephas. as well. And that was, I think, how he was known in one of the letters as well. The other interesting point about this, which I think I understand enough, is you might wonder why Jesus would be, because he's speaking Hebrew, Petros sounds very Greek. But like in a lot of languages, words from one language move into another one quite easily. We use lots of French words and they use lots of ours and so on. And eventually other places and people, the word Petros was used. It became a name from that point of view. But yes, the distinction between the two is right. And yes, I get the masculine feminine bit as well. But there's much more. It's not just that there's a massive piece of rock. There's your Petra. And I can imagine Jesus looking at Petros and then looking up at the Petra and back at Petros, perhaps. Okay, got the message and so on. Or pointing like rabbis always did when they were giving their message and so on. But one of the things we've said that rabbis also do is that they use words that would resonate within the scriptures to their disciples. We've talked about this before, and there'll be lots of examples coming up in the following weeks. This idea of remez, dropping a hint or a clue or an allusion. And the moment that you mention the word rock to hopefully a well-educated Jewish man, he would immediately think of Isaiah 51, as indeed I hope you all do as well. But you know, perhaps our Old Testament knowledge isn't quite as strong as that. But have a look now. And at the beginning of Isaiah 51, here is a reference to a rock. Someone like to tell us about those first two verses of Isaiah 51? And what's going on there?
Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug.
Okay. Do we need the next bit?
Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave birth to you in pain.
So, right, okay. In pain, yeah. So, how does the rock analogy work in that particular bit?
Abraham.
Okay. The rock is Abraham, the quarry is Sarah. Okay. Because she gave birth. So Abraham was the one who was already known as the rock within Jewish thinking. And to Peter, when he was then being called the rock, or that word was being used of him, again, I think that he would be absolutely thrilled. And he was saying, Jesus is comparing me to Abraham. He thinks I'm like Abraham. What was Abraham then? I mean, he was the beginning of something. He was the father of many nations. He was the one that God chose to be his rock. And Jesus is comparing me to him and wants me to be a rock for him, just like Abraham was, and so on. Again, I think this is all part of how a rabbi is not only, he's teaching his disciple, but actually he's building him up as well. He's filling him with confidence. All this is coming out of a response to his revelation. Jesus can now pour all this stuff into Peter because he's seen God at work, or at least on that particular short-lived occasion. Now, there's a lovely rabbinic story, the Midrash they call it, if you might have heard of this, but it's always worth repeating, how they understood Abraham from the point of view of it being a rock. And Jews like to tell stories, and the story that they tell is in order to help us understand something about God. So bear with me while I tell you this. They make this story up because they feel that God must have had a bit of a dilemma when he was thinking about creating the world, because he could already see there's going to be a lot of trouble early on and a lot of wickedness, and it would grow and grow, and he'd have to bring a flood. And oh dear, why on earth bother if that's what it's going to be like? So the story is about a king who wants to build a palace. And he begins digging, searching for solid rock on which he could lay foundations, but he found only mire, mud. He dug in several other sites, always the same results. The king did not give up. He dug in another location, and this time he struck solid rock. Here he said, I will build. And he laid foundations and built. In the same manner, the Holy One, before he created the world, sat and examined all the generations of the flood and said, how can I create the world when those wicked people will appear and provoke me to anger? When, however, the Holy One saw Abraham, he said, here I have found solid rock on which I can build and upon which I can lay the world's foundations. So, okay, fanciful and all the rest of it, but it's like God looking ahead, thinking, shall I do this? Shall I? Is it worth it? And he looks further down and he sees, ah, Abraham. Yes, he's the sort of guy I can partner with. He's the one who'll be a rock for me. Yeah, it's all worth it. I'll go ahead. Now, I don't know whether Peter knew that story. I'm not even sure whether that story was around at that time. Could have been. It's the sort of way in which they retold their scriptural ideas. But certainly there is this idea of Peter, this is a new start now. Okay, and you're at the beginning of it. You're my Abraham. Any comments on that before we look at one of the next
Lynn
things?
Lynn has had a hand up for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Bit controversial to what you've just said, but I've always understood that the rock is God. For example, 2 Samuel 22,
yeah,
it says, the Lord is my rock and my fortress. And in Hebrews, it says, Christ the rock, when they were talking about going through the wilderness.
Exactly, yeah.
The rock that followed them. So okay. That was a nice story you told, but I'd always, it quite thrilled me when you mentioned Jesus pointing, because I've always had problem with wondering what he was saying in 16 on this rock.
Yeah.
And when you said pointing, I now envisage Jesus pointing to himself because he is the rock.
Okay, now I take that point. I've heard that before. And yes, Jesus does become known as the rock and later on. But you see, the problem here is that he says, on this rock I will build. And it's therefore he's saying, on myself I will build. And that analogy doesn't quite work at that point. Later on, fine, yeah, and he's the cornerstone and all the rest of it. But it just doesn't quite fit the way that this sentence works out, as though he's actually saying, on myself I will build. I don't quite buy it, I'm afraid, but I've heard that and I understand where it comes from. And I understand that it's important to think eventually of Jesus as the rock and so on. Okay, others?
Kit is next.
Yeah, I was just thinking on the subject of Remes, the Daniel 2:45 mentioned the rock in the dream.
Yeah, the stone that came and destroyed the statue, yeah. Yeah, and then I don't know if it's that one or the next one, then it becomes a great mountain, doesn't it? It becomes the kingdom. I mean, don't forget, any image can be reused and reused and reused. And that eventually would refer to Jesus, I quite agree, yeah. Or at least prophetically referring to Jesus. So, yeah, thanks for that. We've got lots of others now. Let's try and get them all in.
Betty?
Yes, Paul, thank you. I mean, that's great because that's opened up great things in my mind about the rock and Jesus and Peter and then Abraham and Sarah. And also the fact of what Christine said about the male and female.
Mm.
It makes me think about the bride of Christ and how it's all... It's just got this wonderful picture now of it all coming together and seeing where it's going, because ultimately the bride is the feminine and God is the rock and Jesus is the rock. It all makes sense to me. Thank you.
Keep thinking on that. That's fine. You know, let God keep speaking to you on these things. Let's go to the others fairly quickly.
Caroline?
Oh, yes. Yes, I was going to say something similar to what Lynn said, and you know, because in the Psalms so often Christ is referred to as the rock, Psalm 40, mm-hmm. set my feet upon a rock, and so on. And there are so many Psalms that say that. And also going back to Moses in the wilderness, and he struck the rock, and it says, and the rock was Christ.
Yeah, okay. As I said, the imagery works in so many different ways, and it is applied to Christ. Of course it is, yes, as well. But I've just got to come to terms with, at this point, Jesus is saying he's going to build something on a rock. Now, if you want to think that's himself, that's fine. Not a problem with that. Okay, quickly the other two, please.
Elaine?
Yes, this whole thing about Christ can't build this kingdom on himself surely is not a fruition of that shown in Acts, because Peter is one of the leaders in establishing the first church.
Yeah. Okay.
So hence kind of the whole thing of the rock. They're sort of like taking the gospel. They're the first witnesses of the gospel.
Yeah.
You know, in Acts. Yeah.
Okay.
So does that make sense? Sorry if that sounds possibly spurious.
It makes sense in that this is what Jesus planned for Peter and the other disciples as well. Mm. Yes. It comes back to what does Jesus mean by anyway, I will build, in the sense that in the end he didn't do anything. He left it to his disciples and so on, except perhaps it was him building it. Okay.
Well, surely it would have been him building it eventually with the Holy Spirit, you know, coming.
Yeah, okay. So I don't want to get too bogged down in one little bit like this. But
okay, no.
Take on quickly the other two. Okay,
Helen and then Caroline.
I think I've heard it said that he meant on this revelation, I will build my church.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's.
Yeah, that's what I said was the Protestant version of it, as opposed.
Oh, I see. Okay, sure.
The revelation being what Peter had said.
Yeah.
There was Jesus being able to take people who have declared that themselves, which is what God the Father does to us, and they become another Petros, and he's building them together into his Petra, if you like. Just like it also says in the New Testament, we are all living stones and we're being built together into a holy temple and so on. That's another way of taking the imagery. All these things are great because there's no necessarily one right answer. It's so. We have one more that hasn't spoken?
Yes, sorry. I was just going to say the same about in Peter when he talks about the living stones.
Yeah, okay. And of course, I think that's in Peter, really, isn't it? In his letter.
Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah. Good. Keep thinking on all these lines. Great. Let's move on to the keys, because Peter, again, his confidence is being built up now through another image. Peter, of course, is not going to be given the keys to the gates, pearly or otherwise, but it would mean something to him. Okay, what are keys symbolic of then? If someone's given keys, what does that mean? What does it symbolise?
Unlocking.
I didn't pick that up, I'm sorry.
Unlocking.
Well, okay, unlocking something. But there's what's behind all that? Why would you give someone
access.
Keys?
Access. Access.
Yeah, I'm thinking more than that.
Authority.
Authority, yeah. Keep thinking along those lines.
Letting other people in.
Possibly. Let me give you an illustration then. When I was at school as a teacher, one of my jobs was as the exams officer. That was in the days when we had exams, by the way, in the summer. And I had some certain keys that only three people in the school were allowed to have. Those were the keys to the room that kept the exam papers. Okay, what did that mean about my position? Because I got those keys.
You had a position of trust.
Trust. Keep thinking along those lines as well. What else? What other words might you use for the same thing?
Seniority. Responsibility.
Responsibility. Yeah.
Seniority.
Power. Yeah. Yeah. Or you've been chosen. You've been chosen.
Power.
Power. Okay.
Authority.
Yeah. Okay. Reliability. In other words, it went with a certain position that you wouldn't just give to anybody. Okay. It had to be someone that you feel would look after this. I'll tell you a little story about this, that one day I'd driven back home and I was sitting back here and it suddenly went through my mind, I don't think I've locked that door. What do you think I did?
Went back.
I drove all the way back again to make sure. Yeah. Okay. I took that responsibility seriously. I didn't want to lose my job. but that goes with having keys of that kind anyway. It wasn't just like a key to a classroom and if I'd left the classroom or not, that wouldn't have mattered. So they're very much symbolic of things like trust, reliability, responsibility, and so on. But as we've said, these words are meant to remind them of something. So let's go back to Isaiah. Isaiah 22. And in Isaiah 22, there's a mention of some keys. In fact, let's jump straight to the verse 22 of Isaiah 22, because this is a lovely verse. And I hope if you've not seen this verse before in Isaiah 22, verse 22, you'll suddenly go, oh, that's interesting. Why is it interesting? Where have you read that before?
Revelation.
Yeah, keep going. Just a bit more detail.
Keys of the kingdom.
Isn't it Philadelphia? Is it the church? It's one of the churches.
Well, it's in one of those passages.
Yeah.
But who is it about? Who has the keys?
Jesus.
It's Jesus, yes. This is the verse which is eventually applied to what he says himself, I think, about himself and so on. So that verse, like I also said with Revelation, if you know your Old Testament, it makes a lot more sense. So briefly, what's actually going on here? If you go back to verse 15, and these are the keys of the palace, and you've got this guy who is in charge, a steward called Shebna, and he disgraced himself in the sense that he thought he was so important that he decided to build his tomb there, a nice big, magnificent sort of tomb, so that he would always be remembered and everybody would see it and so on. So he overdid his position. And what God did was to depose him from his office and oust him from his position and take a more humble servant, Eliakim. And it says, verse 21, I will clothe him with your robe, fasten your sash around him, and your authority over to him, and so on, and I will place on his shoulder the key. Okay, so that story resonates with the idea of you give the key to the person who is, well, best suited to it, and not the person who's going to do what Shebna did. And there's another illustration about keys that he might know of in 1 Chronicles 9, and this time it is the keys to the temple, and we learn about the gatekeepers from verse 22 onwards. And in fact, the key is mentioned in verse 27. So 1 Chronicles 9 and verses 22 to 27, and when we get there, we'll realise what's happening. So you've got all these gatekeepers, and in particular, there's four of them. In verse 26, there's four principal ones, probably one for the east, north, west, and south. And it says these four principal gatekeepers were Levites entrusted with the responsibility for the rooms and the treasuries, and they would spend the night stationed round the house of God because they had to guard it, and they had charge of the key for opening it next morning. So their responsibility to go with this key meant that they were prepared to be there all night, guarding it and so on. And I've heard it said, whether it's true or not, but the key was sort of kept under a paving slab in a hole in the floor. But everybody might know where it was. So what did they do? They had to sleep on the floor there on top of it to make sure that nobody could get at the key overnight. But again, it's a story about responsibility of that. And there's a few more bits and pieces along those lines. But as long as we've got the main point, effectively, the real owner of the keys is God himself. He owns the keys to all these things. And if you like, it's Jesus who owns the keys. Certainly they're given to him eventually, because God gives all authority to Jesus. So at this point, when Jesus mentions to Peter that I'm giving you the keys, it means I'm giving you that responsibility that, you know, really belongs to me and to God, but you're sharing in this. You're going to be part of this. So then what does that mean in practice? I mean, it's all very well having this symbol of a key, but no actual key was handed over. It wasn't that he did really have to lock and unlock doors and so on. But he did have to lock and unlock certain things, and that's in the next bit of the same verse. And you should always put, you know, the bits of the verse together and not just pick a bit out and say, oh, that's the keys, and imagine Peter at the pearly gates letting people in and so on, which I don't think is a great eternal reward to give to Peter, as though that's what he's going to do. But there is this extra follow-up based upon, if I give you the keys, it means that you can, and here we come with these words, bind what's bound in heaven and loose what's loosed in heaven. And this is where this verse has been so misunderstood and so on. Here are some very specific Hebrew words, Hebrew idioms. And when you come across the words binding and loosing, forget what other people might have used in terms of spiritual warfare or tying something up. I know the word bind can mean to tie something up in other contexts, but in this sort of context, particularly where you're binding and loosing, those words have a specific meaning within Hebrew idioms and are found within rabbinic literature. And they're used within the context of making rulings, making rabbis, sages, making specific rulings on the law, interpreting the commands. So for instance, you know, someone is asked, can I do this? Can I do that? Is this allowed on the Sabbath? Is this allowed and all the rest of it? The response would be either to bind or to loose. And to bind was to forbid, to loose was to permit or allow. So the ruling was given as either a binding or a loosing, as in, yes, you can do it, no, you can't do it.
Which passage are we actually in, Paul? Some of us are still flipping backwards and forwards.
Oh, well, we're back in Matthew 16.
Ah, right, thank you.
After the keys, after the keys of heaven. I give you the keys of heaven. Yeah. What does that mean? It means that whatever you... And that's the next bit that follows on from the keys.
Thank you.
So, in other words, what would be entailed in this responsibility and so on, it would be to be able to make the right decisions, because in this new community that Jesus is going to build, and we'll have to think more about that another time, the way time's going, there's going to be all sorts of very awkward decisions that will have to be made. And Peter, you're going to be at the forefront of this, and it's an awful responsibility. And to have that kind of responsibility, it could easily make you panic, and it could make you think, oh, I can't do this, and all the rest of it. And the one thing that completely stops you making the right decisions is if you're paralyzed with fear. You know, if you feel you're going to get it wrong, you just end up either not making a decision or just making a complete mess of it all. So this is part of the reassurance to Peter that when you make the decisions you're going to have to make in this new community and decide whether something should be allowed or forbidden, now we've got to understand the way the rest of it is phrased. Because if your translation has, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, I hope you've got a footnote to explain something better than that. Can anyone explain that to us? Or find a translation that doesn't actually say will be bound in heaven. No. So say it again, please.
Will have been bound.
Will have been bound, right. Okay, now why is that better? Because if it just says whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, it's as though, Peter, you make your mind up and God will agree. Okay, so over to you, Peter. And what you decide, God will have to say, oh, okay, I promised I'll do what he says, and so on. But it's really the other way around. It's Peter, your decision will be based upon what God has already decided. God, in other words, will tell you. He will let you know. It's already been sorted out, and you needn't worry, because your decision will reflect what God has already decided. It's not that God will automatically agree with Peter. It's that God will tell Peter what the decision should be, and he will guide him, and so on. Now, we could try and think of many times when this actually took place, actually in practice, was going to work out. And The most significant one, and I'm not going to try and look at others because this one makes the point and the others perhaps a bit more dubious anyway, but the big crucial moment was when Gentiles started to become Christians, basically believers. So Peter goes to Cornelius, the gospel is preached, they believe, the Holy Spirit falls, and suddenly they've got a huge problem. What do we do about Gentiles? Should they be part of us? Should we tell them to be circumcised now? Do we put them under the law? Do we ask them to do all these other things? And if you remember in Acts 15, they had to have this big conference about it in Jerusalem to work out what to do in this situation. And you can read it through yourself and follow the process that they went through, which is quite interesting. But the net result at the end was that they did some binding and loosing. And not just what Peter said on the basis of his experience with Cornelius, but then James, who I think was chairing it as the head of the church in Jerusalem, he eventually came up with something as well. So they did, get it right way around, they did some binding, i.e. don't have to be circumcised, don't have to do this and so on. Sorry, no, they loosed them, sorry, get it right way around. They were loosed from being circumcised and so on. That didn't have to happen, but they were bound in that they had to do other things like the four particular laws that they said they had to keep, like to do with eating meat and sexual immorality and so on. And then that was put into a letter and it was sent off so that everybody knew what had happened and would apply these rules and so on. So that's a very good case of the disciples doing some real proper decision-making of this kind at that crucial moment in the church. And I just want to remind you in a passage which we'll turn to another time, but if you turn the page to Matthew 18:18, you'll find Jesus says exactly the same thing, and this time it's to all the disciples. So Matthew 18, Jesus is teaching all the disciples, so he isn't just setting Peter apart on this. Again, sort of, you know, he's the only guy, this is all about Peter. He's saying it specifically to Peter in Matthew 16, but he's also saying it to all the disciples in Matthew 18, because they're all going to be involved in this. I just mentioned James and so on in Jerusalem. But anybody that was going to go out and plant churches, look after churches and so on, would be faced with a whole range of new situations unlike any before. And let's face it, you know, these guys were still largely young fishermen come disciples, and suddenly Jesus is saying you're going to be a rock and have this responsibility and I'm going to build a community and you're at the forefront of it. And they think, oh, they might be thrilled at the thought of it, and then suddenly the panic sets in. Oh dear, what does that mean I'm going to have to do? So this is all about giving Peter the right sort of assurance. So we've looked at this as a big life-defining moment for Peter. The name change, as always, is significant in the Bible. So that was certainly part of it. And it fits in with what we saw later on in John about Peter being restored. And someone thankfully rightly said that meant Peter would now think of himself as a rock again. Imagine now, you see, when Peter felt his discipleship had been completely wrecked and he was no longer a disciple, that was not a small thing for him, because it meant all of this stuff that we just looked at, he'd just thrown all that away. So it was sort of even bigger thing for him. But he was back. Peter will be as solid as a rock. He'll be a founding part of something much bigger than he could have imagined. He will reliably be able to lock and unlock situations that are beyond his understanding at present. And he will make complex decisions that are guaranteed to be in line with God's will. And Peter may not have understood all the future implications of what Jesus had just said to him, but he'll have understood all the words, all the references, all the idioms, all the Old Testament stuff that goes with it. And he'll have known a lot about that, so that he would feel greatly encouraged, strengthened, and so on. So, a couple of people already want to come in with something. Is it Jackie first?
Yes.
Thank you.
I've heard this explained, I think from a Hebraic perspective, but I can't actually tell you what my source is. It's just sometimes when something, when I get real good information, I write it in my Bible. And what I've written down about the keys is that Jesus gave Peter authority in three specific sort of areas and keys. And the first one was first to preach to the temple Jews and unlock the temple. The second you've already mentioned was to the Gentiles with Cornelius.
Okay.
And the third was in Samaria, that Peter was the first to sort of preach there. And that the keys that God gave him was the responsibility and the authority to be the first in these three situations.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, no.
But be filled by the Holy Spirit was the other bit.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not questioning this. I'm just saying, was he the first in Samaria? I can't remember that bit. Was he the first in Samaria? I can understand. So you're saying Pentecost, first of all, to the Jews, then with Cornelius.
Philip was in Samaria, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's why I'm not trying to put a complete dampener on that. But the point is the same, that as we come back to it, Peter was the leading guy in all this. As I say, one tradition elevates him to papacy, but we don't need to diminish him instead of the fact that Jesus did want him to be at the first. So it was certainly at the forefront of all these things. And yes, I'd like the idea that fits in with the keys, whether there's two, three or four, it doesn't really matter as such. But thank you. And do we have someone else?
It's Pat.
It's just, I was thinking of Ananias and Sapphira.
Ah, yes, go on.
And about lying to the Holy Spirit. And
yeah, I might have mentioned that one, which I will now because you mentioned it. Was that a binding and loosing situation? What fascinates me about that is that the first one, which was the man, Ananias, wasn't it? I don't think Peter expected that was going to happen. Okay. Peter didn't say anything about that. It's just that God seemed to do that. And then Peter, having sort of learnt from that, seen what heaven had decided, when Sapphira comes in and she says the same thing, it's the same lie. At that point, Peter says, the men who have just taken out your husband are going to take you out. So it's almost now as though he's said, well, I know now what heaven does in these situations, so I will declare it. And it happened. So, you know, that's a good example of how that was an important decision that he made. And it seems that he was learning on the job almost from that. Thank you. There was another occasion when there might have been some binding and loosing when they had to solve the problem of the widows that weren't being looked after. And they set apart, was it seven people with Stephen and so on? You know, was that a similar sort of decision? You know, you can decide yes or no on that sort of thing, but the main decisions would be the big ones that would affect the building of the church that Jesus was doing. Any more thoughts, comments, questions? We've looked at a lot, I know that. It's just amazing how much is in some of these verses when you start to unpack them in this way, isn't it? So, is that it? Everybody had their say? Everyone exhausted?
Sorry, I was just thinking of the high priest was the one with the authority to make the decisions, wasn't he? And he used the Urim and the Thummim. So this would be sort of almost like giving them that kind of authority. They'd understand it, is that?
Yeah, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Very good.
Well, what we are going to look at next time, start off with, is the passage in Matthew 18 that I said, just glanced to see that this same thing was being used with all the disciples and so on, because there's a lot more in that particular passage. And what I haven't mentioned in the Matthew 16 passage, skirted over it at the moment, but will say something, and I don't think most of you will be surprised on that. I haven't explained what church means. I will build my church. If you heard me carefully, I tried to use a different word, didn't I? But more on that next time, because it's going to crop up in Matthew 18. And that will be one of our studies for next time. Thank you very much. Shall we stop the recording there so that...